tomorrow will be what I call religion and public life, and that's a very hot topic in many places today. We all are aware, I think, of the debate over prayer, you know, prayer in school. But now, in fact, there's something going on in Congress right now. They're bringing back what they call the moment of silence as an alternative for this. So that's one thing we want to talk about. And the whole issue of, you know, how much should there be, how much any kind of religious observance at all should there be in the schools, things like Christmas carols in the schools or in the public domain would be things like manger scenes. Some of you are from around Portland, and you know, the big battle they've had over the statue of Christ on the hill, isn't it? If anybody here from Portland, hopefully somebody will show up for tomorrow for that sort of thing. A lot of things like that. The equal access bill, that one actually passed Congress last week, where right now it looks like religious organizations of students, obviously of high schools, public school students, will be able to use classroom facilities after hours, after class hours, the way, you know, the chess club or some other club would. And that raises some kind of questions that I want to save for tomorrow. And that'll be at the same time, and then on Friday I'm here, it'll be at 4 o'clock on this. So today, I have to have a couple words of background on this, because otherwise I think some of my remarks might be misunderstood. We want to talk about what I call, and a lot of people call, the born-again movement, and when it got started, why it got started. It's going to be rather hard to define, but I think it's important to try to define it. And I think one thing I want to sort of share right from the beginning, because it came up once when I did not quite this subject, but something like it when I was on sabbatical here before, was one student said, well, why just talk about the things that divide Christians? Why not talk about the things that unite us and the things that you know, can bring us together? Aren't you really, in a sense, contributing to our divisions? And if you even like our suspicions by talking about things and putting labels like evangelical or born again or mainline or confessional or whatever these things on people. And I'm very much aware of that, and I don't intend to use the remarks, obviously, to divide or to cast aspersions or to be in any sense judgmental. Because as I said, I think once last week, the core really of the born again movement is just at the instant conversion kind of experience. And that's the thing I think that separates them more than any of the others. And certainly if you look in the history of Christianity, there are some very impressive people, very impressive, you know, instant conversion experiences. Paul on the road to Damascus. St. Augustine, the famous, you remember in his confessions, the famous moment in the garden when he heard a voice talking to him, and he knew that his, you know, his time had come. Luther had what he called his tower experience, and where he calls it actually being born anew. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, had, what was that wonderful phrase, his heart strangely warmed. At Aldergate Chapel in London, if any of you have been there, sort of the citadel really of Methodism, the way I suppose Wartburg Castle is for, you know, for Lutherans. And we all know Amazing Grace, and remember in this hymn, and the second verse is always "The hour I first believed." The man himself had been a slave trader, and you can imagine the sort of the guilt that had piled up on him over a period of time, and then the sudden release that came when he knew that all that had happened. So when I talk about the born-again of the evangelical, and sometimes I do get off into, sometimes I try for humor, and sometimes the humor gets off into sarcasm, and I don't really mean that in any, you know, any kind of serious sense. But I don't mean to divide. What I'm trying to do in these lectures is something which I've tried to do in my teaching and in my writing, and that is to try to explain and try to focus on what I think are important trends that are going on in American religious and political life today, and then hopefully to help people reach their own conclusions about this. I think generally I can live with that. In one of my books, which I did on the new Christian right, I was criticized for not giving the answers on this. And at least the reader understood what I was trying to do, that I was trying to avoid giving the answers. And I take that, you know, as a compliment. The same thing is true when I did the thing on the charismatics, which we'll do again on Friday. So I'm trying to analyze, and I'm trying to follow the advice. I don't think we have any of the old time oldies here, but I follow the advice of one of my favorite teachers, Art Paulson, who said once when he was teaching, and it's something I think it's good for, you know, for anybody in this kind of position, never overestimate their knowledge or the facts, never overestimate their knowledge or the facts, but never underestimate their intelligence. And I think that's a nice way of putting it. I'm dealing with adults, and I think everybody, you know, is perfectly capable of making up their own minds. And hence when I have to say that by way of preface, because I have strong convictions and feelings, and somebody asked me the other day too about what do you think about, you know, the end time sort of thing and everything, and I was fairly reluctant to do that because I think that that's just the way I operate, and I say that because otherwise I think some people are going to misunderstand some of the remarks. As you to get to it, I got one right there. Okay.
Doesn't count.
Doesn't count. Yeah. Well, I sort of how do I say it? I sort of let the Greek Hebrew team just sort of fade away. I think I decided not to keep score about anything, and you know, including flies. And I'd rather be hiking, but that's my own, you know. I'd rather that's my own personal feeling. Okay. Anyway, I'd like to put some of you know resources on the board. And one of the best of the new books on the evangelical movement is by Donald Blesch, who teaches at Wartburg, on the future of evangelical Christianity by Doubleday, 1983. And not only for your own reading, but as I've suggested before, these may be helpful for the parish library. I was so excited once I was up, and it was a little embarrassing. I did an adult forum up at, North Minneapolis and Plymouth. Right on 101. Anyway, I got there a little early, and I was looking around and I saw two of my books in the church library. Wow, this is pretty nice. And I checked in, and neither book had ever been checked out. So that took care of that in a hurry. Modesty is becoming okay. Anyway. Basically, I use these terms as ways of understanding where we are the same and where we are different, and why we are the same, and why is it sometimes when we go to other churches we have different kinds of experiences. And what does that mean, and does that mean that we should, you know, necessarily just keep accenting the differences, or should it mean that we can, since we better understand the differences, we can find those areas then where there is, more room for cooperation? I would like to think the latter is the case. One real problem with defining the so-called evangelical movement is just the problem of definition. There are so many different people who have so many different ideas of what it should be. And Blesch has a long definition. I won't read it here. It's about 4 pages. Some professors do go on and on and on and on. Just like the snow here in the wintertime. If you saw Dan's slideshow the other night about it, it just keeps going on and on. So I'd rather have a rather shorter, briefer definition, and one by an evangelical himself, although I'm fully aware of the fact that Lutheranism has a proud claim to the title of evangelical. I've got one colleague, and I know Terry would appreciate this. When I talk about evangelicals, E. Clifford Nelson feels very strongly that only Lutherans have a claim to the title of evangelical. And that aside, having paid my dues to Cliff, because a good friend and a significant mentor, and we taught a class together for a long time, I think that I would go along with Marty, and that is, you have to call people what they want to be called. And therefore, I'll go along with this. Okay. Basically, what is meant here is something by Professor John Johnstone of Fuller Theological Seminary in California. And he argues that it is not, the first of all, the most important thing, it is not a sort of subjective, personal, interior kind of experience which is totally mystical and totally separated or isolated from anybody else. He asserts that it is far more than having some superficial inner experience that somehow produces a vague sense of psychological well-being. Instead, Johnston said, there is a complete transformation, an overhaul from the inside out, which results in our reversing directions, in transferring loyalties, and in changing commitments as a major first step. And of course, drawing from Nicodemus in John 3, what must I do to be born again? And RSV translated as, what must I do to be born, to be born anew, not born again, but entering your mother, re-entering the mother's womb and all that sort of thing. But that really has to start there, because that separates, I think that's the most important differentiation, that separates in general terms the two major categories within Protestantism, and actually I should say within Catholicism too, between what we call the nature school and the nurture school. The nurture school is where the Catholics, Lutherans, Episcopalians, and most mainliners would be, that through the steady day in and day out, year in, year out use of the resources, especially the sacramental uses of the church, a person finds their life growing and enlarging and expanding and deepening in understanding and in faith and in commitment. and especially through the especially through the use of the sacraments, and that there is no necessary need for a sudden instant born again or born anew kind of experience. Whereas, and this obviously also has to do with infant baptism, and I think you can all understand, the reasons for infant baptism and why infant baptism sets in, or fits in, I should say, nicely with the nurture school. Obviously, the infant himself or herself doesn't understand what's happening, but we've all been through that, so I don't have to spend time on that. Not so, you see, according to what they call the nature school. They are the ones who argue that when the time comes for a person to understand the full implications of the life of faith, the commitment to faith, then that person should have the right to and the opportunity and should be challenged to make the decision for herself for himself, and that there is ample, they'll argue, ample scriptural evidence for this kind of experience, and that therefore once this has happened, according then to what Johnston says here, there is a reversing of direction, a transferring of loyalties, and a changing of commitments all the way through. That would be the very, very important one. I think a second one, which I don't want to go into in any great detail, although it's kind of fun, because Lutherans went through this at least to some degree a little before, and people like Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Methodists went through it somewhat differently about a half century ago. There is a marked, distinctive quality about evangelicals in trying to define them in their, their understanding of the full authority of the factuality of Scripture. Sometimes, to give this a label, this is called the inerrancy question. To what extent, when there is a conflict between, let's say, historical fact or scientific fact and a certain way of reading the Scriptures, where do you choose? How do you come down on this sort of thing? Where do you make the difference? I'm not talking just about the Genesis 1 and 2 being 24 hours each of 6 days or something like this, but so many other things that take place there. And what all fundamentalists and many evangelicals would hold to would be a rather strict inerrancy position, in which when there is a conflict between human scholarship and research and understanding, as you would find in the natural sciences and in the social sciences for that matter also, or history, and the record as they read it in Scripture, you would come down on the side of Scripture being inerrant as a very important point. And what's happening now, as I say, the evangelicals and the fundamentalists are sort of, in a sense, catching up to what's happened before. There are battles, if you think there are battles, let's say, in the Lutheran Church or the Catholic Church or some of the other, there are incredible battles taking place in the evangelical circle, starting in 1976 with a book by the editor then of Christianity Today, Harold Inzel, on the battles for the Bible. You have people who won't talk to each other within evangelical circles. You've got purges going on. Somebody has been using, what was the idea? Somebody was dropped from the Evangelical Theological Society because he said that he didn't think that Mary used all the words that are attributed to her in the Magnificat. And that was enough to drum him out of the Evangelical Theological Society. You get some idea of that. I can talk about the inerrancy thing a little bit later on. But I think, first of all, the born-again subjective experience. Secondly, the question about the authority of Scripture. And then I'd be glad to talk about the Lutheran position on that also as another definition of what makes an evangelical. And third, get back to my notes here, the born-again generally maintain it is their responsibility to spread the faith, to evangelize. And of course, you can say right away, well, so too do others outside of that particular circle. But somehow I think the style of the evangelicals is different. Often one picks up overtones or assumptions that the instant conversion experience divides the world into Christians and church members. I know when my children came home, they said that some of their friends who had been baptized and had gone to confirmation and all the rest in one of the Lutheran churches in Northfield had now become Christians. Well, I didn't want to explode in front of my son, show him that sort of thing, but it gave me the opportunity for a long, and as it turned out to be, rather fruitful dialogue between us on the fact that just because you'd had this kind of subjective experience, that meant that you were now a Christian. But the same thing is true with, you hear the word Christian radio stations, or Christian television programs, or Christian You know, bookstores. That's another one. We've got in the Twin Cities, we've got the Northwestern bookstores, which specialize in these things. Although we do also have other bookstores, and I have to say that, just put in a plug here gratuitously, the Luther Northwestern bookstore in St. Paul is considered one of the best bookstores really in the country. Incredible kinds of resources and things that they have there. So if you can have high academic standards and still have, I think, a solid religious bookstore itself. But anyway, born-again people certainly speak freely about having God direct their daily activities. They are far less puzzled over the ambiguities and mysteries of faith and are far more determined to find now, after their life-changing experience, just how God is working within them. And that's what I mean by style. Many of them are much more concerned with finding what is, you know, the Christian interpretation of this experience or the Christian meaning of that. Later on, I'm going to read, they believe that there is such a thing as a Christian novel as opposed to, you know, other kinds of novels. And are much less, put it another way, they are much less open to finding, you know, the works and the ways of God in the secular world than would be some people in the mainline churches. So there usually has to be a more explicit kind of clear religious understanding as to exactly what's going on here. I wish I had brought along a piece by your colleague, now deceased Warren Quambeck, on understanding God in the secular world. It's a really fine way of doing this, because I thought for a long time that unless you sort of said Jesus saves you from your sins, you weren't really sort of really testifying or witnessing to this. I'll give you one example. In graduate school, my roommate and I were discussing William Ng's, it happened to be a play, but then it made it into a movie, Come Back, Little Sheba, a wonderful thing with Burt Lancaster and, who was it she went on? Shirley, it'll come to me, and a story, a very powerful, tragic kind of story. And we were discussing why the story ended in kind of tragedy. And coming out of my background, I said that the reason the story ended in a tragedy is that they didn't accept Jesus as their personal Lord and Savior. Well, he didn't know what I was talking about, for one thing, coming out of a whole different kind of religious tradition on that. But I sort of had the idea that this is sort of the way in which everything can be understood. Unless you stand up and say Jesus is your personal Lord and Savior, obviously you aren't being religious. And that bothered me, frankly, for a long, long time, and it took a lot of agony and sweat before I got over to a much different kind of understanding for this. Okay, so I think that would be my basic definition of the three things that would characterize evangelicals or the born again as opposed to those in the main line. Okay, now, why after a long period of being sort of considered rather unusual or strange or odd, my father-in-law used to call them the holy jumpers, and so on, why did they suddenly come into the into such prominence with such force? And why have they sort of lasted in that way? Because for a long time, the evangelicals, especially in the 20th century, were considered to be sort of quaint or at best sort of have a nostalgic appeal, but they really weren't considered to be very significant. But then suddenly in 1976, some of you remember, Time magazine announced that year to be not only the bicentennial year, but to be the year of the evangelical. And I want to go into some of the historical reasons for that now, having made my definition. Again, as Terry and I are doing, I want to cite here Martin Marty. He argued that in looking for why it happened when it did, and that's what historians are always trying to do, why did it happen at that particular time in history? Why did it happen then? He argued that there were so many serious, large global and national problems that were occurring over which people had no control. Inflation was running out of control at that time. Unemployment, the whole question was Watergate, the whole question was Vietnam. So many different things. It seemed as though there was, a steady increase in crime and vice, so many different things going on in the world that were happening, the arms race and all these things, that according to Marty here, people, quote, snuggled back into what they could control, namely their inner life. You couldn't do anything about this particular problem or that particular problem, but you could control the things which were nearer and closer to you, namely your inner life. And once you felt some sort of control over that, then obviously you wanted to have some control over that. You wanted to find out where were the churches and what kind of churches were talking about this kind of direct, immediate, personal kind of experience, where you could be made to feel good about yourself again. I think that was one very important factor in the 1970s. We get the whole human potential movement also that gets started in the 1970s, or the 60s actually, and then into the 1970s. which would indicate that some people had sort of abdicated and given up on sort of social commitment the way you found in the 60s, the peace movement, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the ecological movement, and had retreated into sort of more, you know, a privatized kind of understanding. And I think that's one important thing. The second thing is, for whatever reasons, and I want to go into them a little bit in detail after I make this, use this quotation here, for all practical purposes, contemporary American culture no longer stigmatized or ridiculed the born again, as they had been before. If some of you ever have a chance to read or reread the writings of a famous American journalist in the 1920s and the 1930s by the name of H.L. Mencken, you'll get a pretty good picture of what, you know, the general American public attitude was towards evangelicals and Puritans. Mencken was the one who made the famous definition about Puritans in American life, who went on into, you know, the Congregational and the Presbyterian Church and the others. Mencken says Puritanism was that suspicion that somebody somewhere was enjoying himself, and that they wanted simply, you've all heard it, all right. So we'll move ahead here, all right. American culture no longer ridiculed the born again. Here is a speech in 1974 by somebody you'll remember from 1980, Congressman John Anderson. Remember from Rockford? Whatever happened to John Anderson? We're supposed to be talking about this week, but I decided we'd talk about the evangelicals himself. Congressman John Anderson, himself an evangelical, said this to the National Association of Evangelicals Conference, and I think the quotation is self-explanatory. It was they, meaning the liberals here, who denied the supernatural acts of God, conforming the gospel to the canons of modern science. It was they who advocated laws and legislation as a modern substitutionary atonement for the sins of mankind. It was they who were the friends of those in position of political power. They were the beautiful people, and we, you will recall, were the kooks. We were regarded as rural, reactionary, illiterate fundamentalists who just didn't know any better. Well, things have changed. Now they are the kooks, and we are the beautiful people. Our evangelists have the ready ear of those in positions of highest authority. Our churches are growing and theirs are withering, which was certainly true in the 1970s. And I think this is a theme which, you know, picked up. Now that we've got the momentum going, the energy, getting good press from Time Magazine, Newsweek, and the others, we are sort of getting back and getting even to getting even with them. Okay, I think those would be a couple other reasons. I think there are other reasons why the evangelical movement took off when it did. And these are probably more cultural than anything else on this. I think probably the best way to understand the resurgence of evangelicalism is to put it in sort of an academic category, but it's, I think, the best one I can use here, and that's to see it as a, sometimes as a folk religion or sometimes called a popular religion. Peter Williams has a very good book simply entitled, not surprisingly, Popular Religion in America. And it's more of movement which comes, if you want to put it, from the laity and less from the ecclesiastical, you know, sources of leadership in this country, and I think that helps explain from this. Now, what characterized, you know, this kind of popular religion here? He says, Williams has three characteristics. He said, it existed apart from, or at least in tension, with the prevailing religious spirit of the day. In other words, and what he means is that the prevailing religious spirit of the day was basically the liberation and protest movements of the 60s, which went into the 70s. As I've mentioned before, civil rights, women's, the peace movement, the ecological movement. There were a lot of people who didn't go along with those, who saw those as, you know, moving the country and the churches in what they considered to be the wrong, you know, the wrong direction. And so, therefore, a new movement gets started looking for direction and looking for momentum and existing, you see, apart from what you might call almost a semi-official or establishment kind of emphasis that was so characteristic of the mainline churches at that time. I think that's important. Secondly, evangelicalism needs to flourish, needed no specialist. It needed no recognized ecclesiastical leader or official denominational sanctions in order to have its claims legitimized for power. It was something which could and did arise, you see, from the people without a great deal of attention to having it sanctioned by, as he says, official ecclesiastical leaders, such as you would find in some of the mainline churches, such as the Lutheran or the Episcopalian, or to a degree also the Catholic Church. All right. And thirdly, and to get into the point I was making before about this differentiation between Christian and secular, the adherents enthusiastically search for signs of divine intervention or manifestation in the realms of everyday life. I think that's an important point with the rise or the flourishing of the born-again movement. They enthusiastically search for signs of divine intervention or manifestations in the realm of everyday experience. In other words, they're much more sensitive to the fact that there is a sort of a meaning, a direction, a purpose in far more of our everyday lives than a lot of other people are willing to give credit for. And this shows up also with the charismatics, whom I want to talk about on Friday. But I think this is true with evangelicals, and they see this, they want this kind of understanding, they want this kind of emphasis, and they don't find it in the established kinds of churches where some of them had been going, but they do find it in the in some of the more freelance, more spontaneous forms of religious expression, which shows up in the born again movement itself. Okay, so what happens then in the 1970s? Is that evidence appears that there is momentum gaining for this kind of new emphasis, this kind of popular religion. Probably the star of the show in the 1970s was Jimmy Carter. He came almost out of oblivion, and with his frequent witnessing to his born-again experience and his claims, you remember, to represent the common people, he helped popularize the born-again experience. People could no longer claim that a serious candidate for the presidency, you see, was something of a kook or a fanatic or an escapist. Carter was representative of an older strain in American religious life, which now became legitimated far more than had been the case before. The born-again resurgence also flourished, and this is very important, outside denominational circles. It thrived and thrived today in such parachurch groups as Full Gospel Businessmen's Association. I think FGBMI, does that ring a bell with some of you? Very strong in some parts of the country. If I have time, I'll tell a couple stories about once I was invited there and talk about a mismatch. I think that's the best way of putting it. But the Full Gospel Businessmen's Association, or groups like Campus Crusade, or some of you know from your situations, the many paragroup or parachurch groups such as Navigators or Young Life or Inner Varsity that really weren't going anywhere in the 1960s, suddenly in the 1970s, sometimes to the chagrin of parish pastors who have to compete with Young Life or Navigators in their local, in their local situations, these groups are moving rapidly. Okay, or there was increasing support for such television stalwarts as Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, and Rex Humbard, plus ones I talked about yesterday. Okay, then too, and I think this has to be said as another reason for why it's flourishing, they suddenly become, not suddenly, but it takes time, but it seemed to be suddenly, they can become very skillful in the use of mass media, especially television. People tell me, for instance, that if you want to get a master's degree in what we call religious communication, the two best schools, just for the technological part of the whole thing, the two best schools are Oral Roberts University in Tulsa and Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina. They simply know how to teach people how to get, how to put together good, what they would call good religious programming in both television and radio. And that's one reason that the TV evangelists flourish. Their color is better, their sound, the way they move the program along, the direction is simply much better. I have to tell one joke here I didn't use yesterday, but it's true. I was being interviewed by John Gallus once, who was the religion editor for a reporter for Channel 4 on the Twin Cities, on a book on the moral majority. And we got talking about why it was that religious programming was so much better done under the fundamentalists and the evangelicals. And I was talking about light and color and everything else. And I said, and John comes from a very, well, he's Greek Orthodox, but he represents a very mainline sort of emphasis. And I said, it's true with most mainline TV programs, what they consider to be a good or an effective set for a television show is two chairs, a table, and an old plastic potted palm in the background. And I looked behind me, and there was an old plastic potted palm, right there. And John was very, moved right ahead. The next question came out, just like that, so we never had to concentrate on that sort of thing. And John never said a word afterwards. I've seen him a couple, I'll have to talk to him again afterwards. There I was, biting the hand that fed me, I guess, or something else like that. Okay, skillful use of mass media. And it helped make more legitimate, the born-again ministries of budding celebrities. You can say, really, with the evangelicals that they concentrate on the celebrity, as believer and as witness. For the faith, as to how God has, with the born-again experience has made a difference in their life. And the list here, and I'll just repeat some of them briefly. Charles Colson, the one, you remember, who said that when he had been with Nixon, he would have walked over his grandmother if Nixon had told him to do it. and then suddenly had this remarkable conversion experience, and is doing very good work apparently now with prison rehabilitation. But Colson is one. Eldridge Cleaver would be another. Anita Bryant, Pat Boone, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, my favorite, Linda Wonder Woman Carter was in there, and I won't make any editorial comment. And what's true, what's going on now is that this sort of thing doesn't go away. Guess who is one of the biggest hits on the Pat Robertson show? John DeLorean. Would you believe had a born-again experience? I kid you not, John DeLorean, which may mean that he is feeling some guilt over the particular shenanigans that apparently, at least allegedly, went on. But that was too much for a couple of other. Even Jerry Falwell said that was expecting a little bit too much. The Lord can move in mysterious ways, but to have John DeLorean come forward with a born-again, I've been saved kind of approach was asking a whole lot. With this sort of thing, and that obviously, other TV celebrities would be the TV quarterbacks. I have a theory that America treats its TV quarterbacks, Roger Staubach, Terry Bradshaw, Fran Tarkenton, and all the rest, the way the Greeks treated their demigods back in the, way back in the 4th and 5th century B.C. They can almost do no wrong. And Fran, of course, himself, Tarkenton, was a preacher's kid and could handle himself in all these kinds of, situations. Okay. Now, it flourished because of TV exposure, but it also flourished, and here we want to get into some more serious kinds of analysis, not just because of the what I call celebrityitis on this sort of thing, but because when it was sort of injected or tried on the local level, the grassroots level, it found a ready kind of response. That is to say, the born again might never have turned into the born again movement, might never have become very strong, had it not been able really to touch the lives of its adherents directly and concretely on the local level, in areas of direct and immediate concern, and in a form very attractive and intelligible to those who were seeking. I'm speaking here, and I want to go into a little detail here on some case studies of two or three groups, and I want to go into just one specific group. But in the 1970s, to give two examples, one would be Bill Gothard's Basic Youth Conflicts. Does that ring a bell? Bill Gothard's a few, and that had tremendous appeal. In St. Paul, for instance, they brought out 28,000 people Sunday through Thursday nights for some pretty dull lectures, I thought, where you just sat there and took notes. And yet our church sent up, St. Peter's in Northfield sent up three busfuls, and I don't even know what came from the other Lutheran churches at that time. Tremendous appeal at that time because Gothard had a clear, unambiguous kind of message, which a lot of people, especially parents, were anxious to hear at that time. And hence, the evangelical approach touched on a lot of lives which might not otherwise have been so responsive. And again, Basic Youth Conflicts is another, parachurch organization. It exists alongside, parallel to, that's what I mean by para here, parallel to, but not within the denominations themselves. And some of you, I know, are parish pastors, and you've had to face the decision whether or not you are going to cooperate with some of these parachurch groups, or you're going to stay within the boundaries of your own denominations. It's a very difficult kind of decision, because what happens when you're bored comes all, that has heard from somebody's sister who heard Bill Gothard down, let's say, in St. Louis or something else, that this is just terrific and we want it, for our congregation. And, if you aren't doing it, there must be something wrong with your parish at this time. Okay. I think, besides Bill Gothard, probably the area that has shown the strengths and the continuing strengths of the evangelical movement more than any other is in what we call the Christian day school movement. I think this is, and this is what I want to concentrate on. I could talk about some of the others, but about the Christian novel, for instance, I've got some interesting things here. But I think it's in the Christian day school movement that we see the conflict and the opportunities that evangelicals and the born again are using, more successfully there probably than anywhere else. And it's both a negative. There are both negative and positive reasons for the Christian day school movement, flourishing the way that it did. The last statistics I had on this were from 1982, and we think that there are somewhere between 11% and 12% of all grade school, K through 12 children now attending, in one form or another, a religious, day school situation in this country, which is a remarkable growth from the period before. There have all, and of course it has to be said, there are all kinds of different, you know, religious schools. Missouri Synod has had a long and honorable tradition, parochial schools. And it was always fun to me when I was being able to read some newspapers, and for instance, Racine, Wisconsin, where they had a Catholic parochial school and they had a Lutheran parochial school. And what was it in basketball? I think the headline was that Martin Luther smashes Holy Angels 62-41 or something else like that. And unless you knew what was going on there, you would think that the Reformation had gotten out of hand or something else like that. But Missouri has had a long and honorable tradition in this, and certainly the Catholic schools go way back to the beginning. The first thing the Catholics did almost is in this country was to set up their parochial schools. And so I'm not talking about those in particular, because they have gone on, nor am I talking about some of the older, more established ones. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, we have Minnehaha Academy, for instance, a strong and a very good academic program there, and we're always happy at St. Olaf to get students from Minnehaha, because they are well-versed, and they're ready to work, and have had a long tradition. The same thing can be said with some of the private schools. The Episcopalians have had a long tradition in private schools also, at Shattuck and at Brick and some of the others. But what I am talking about are some of the new schools which have gotten a start in our day, really, as I suggested, for both negative and positive reasons. They see the public schools basically as failing. And the argument is that the public schools by this time have had enough time to prove themselves and have proved that the public schools, especially in the high schools, simply aren't being able to, you know, to make the grade. They would argue, for instance, that the public schools have become so acculturated, so much a part of our secular life, that there is no way in which, even by trying through different kinds of sort of auxiliary groups, to have any kind of hope for them all together. They see, and certainly this shows up, for instance, in some of the things I'll be talking about tomorrow too, they see the public school as having given up on some things which they don't want to have given up for their children. Just two or three examples for this. Some of them don't want their children to have the kind of sex education that is taught in the public schools. And they say that's a part of our religious freedom to be able to teach our children in this aspect of life in the way we believe is right and in harmony with our faith. Therefore, we shouldn't have to have our children subjected to that sort of thing. They object, for instance, also to forced busing, as another example in public schools. Why should, these parents, why should their children be subject to some sort of experimentation on the part of some sociologists and others, whereas in America, they would argue, the neighborhood, and that's always a code word here, the neighborhood always has primacy or should have primacy on that sort of thing. Or another one would be the whole issue of teaching of creationism in the curriculum. And a real battle is going on there. Last year I gave a talk here on the struggle in creationism, and I didn't repeat it again this year because the movement for all practical purposes is basically stalemated. Some states have it, and where you can teach creationism equally with evolution, it's now in front of the courts. In other states, it's not being done. But these are examples, you see, sex education, forced busing, and creationism, of the belief by a lot of parents and a lot of churches, that the evangelical churches, that the public schools can no longer obviously be trusted. And furthermore, they have further evidence. The decline in the SAT scores would be an example of where they see a serious slippage. And the failure, to teach basics in reading and writing and all that go along with that. And I have to say just one example, although I certainly don't think the Northfield schools are guilty of this. My daughter was somewhat surprised when she signed up for a course in American humor. Sounds good, Mark Twain and some of the others, wouldn't that be sort of a delightful sort of thing? And what it turned out to be was 6 weeks of Marx Brothers movies. And they simply went in and, watched. Now, I think that's great to watch Marx Brothers movies. I like them, and I still think they're among the best, but, that was all. It was just entertainment so that the teachers could have a break. Okay, they have given up on the basics, the witness of decline in the SAT scores. They object to the fact that the teachers are all now unionized, and the fact that the NEA, for instance, has endorsed unanimously Walter Mondale as further evidence that the teachers only think in terms of politics and what they can get for themselves, rather than what they rather than being the sort of dedicated mentors that they used to be. You won't find you know, the old sort of saintly types of teachers anymore. My brother came back from his parish in the West, trying to find some of those old saintly teachers that he remembered from school. And we tried to explain to him that they just don't exist in, you know, public schools anymore, because you know, the professional standards have changed a great deal. Furthermore, parents, the argument against the public schools is that dope, liquor, and the like are readily available, often instantly available to anyone who can get inside the schools, and that there's little that school authorities can do about it. Some argue that sex education courses are a little more than soft porn. Some object to use of Sidney Simon's values clarification. I'd be glad to talk about that. Does that ring a bell, Sidney Simon's values clarification, with some of you? Okay. They call it a clever Trojan horse ploy for introducing relativism and secularism in new morality in the school, which they say is the old immorality rather than, you know, the new morality. They find that religious faiths are excluded or ridiculed in the science courses. Literature classes read smut, not the classics, and of course there is always a problem of physical violence, which needs no elaboration on this part. All right. So there is a strong case in a negative sense to be made against the you know, the public school that's taking place, and I think some of you are ready to reply, and I'll be glad to you know, to listen to that, because I'm a teacher myself, and I identify with teachers. You want to reply right away?
Was patriotism another one of their?
I'm coming to patriotism. Yeah, right. That's important. Whatever happened to patriotism, right?
Are you open for questions as you go along?
Yeah. What have you got now? I shouldn't say now, but.
Okay, we go back to this born again thing, yeah. And as I see it, the born again people are looking for the gospel.
Yep.
Yeah. And somewhere along the line, in our Lutheran churches, our pastors are staying to the old history, to the Old Testament, and this is why we're losing people to the new church.
Be careful there about the Old Testament, man.
He's Old Testament.
Yeah, I know, but you know, in Minnesota, we've got a church. They call it the Church of the Living Word.
Yeah.
And it's picked up people from all the churches, and that's strictly the gospel. And this is what it is, born again. This is what the people are looking for. You see?
That opens up I think we're right at the heart of the thing, right at the instant, you know, instant identification of the problem. I would, to clarify it here, the question becomes, once you've had the born, one of my questions with the born again, once you've had that experience, what happens to you next? You know, what happens, shouldn't there be some significant difference in your life? I don't want to get into the justification versus sanctification argument, because that's, you know, goes round and round, so sort of thing. But I think it should make some difference in your life, and you know, there are all kinds of obligations and responsibilities, because one criticism I have with some born-again people is that that experience becomes the only thing that's ever happened to them in their life, and they talk about it over and over and over again. And instead of sort of taking it out, I'll give you a good example of what I used to, and I'll talk about Friday when I went to the charismatic meetings for such a long time. There was one ex-alcoholic who got up and gave a tremendous testimony about, you know, he said, God grabbed me right out of the gutter and pulled me up and did a tremendous job. And then he has gone from that time on, and like you telling me about the other day, and has dedicated the rest of his life to helping other people. And that's what I'm trying to say is it should happen after, if there's a born-again experience, fine. But then it should show up in the way you relate to other people, and not just you know, keep on going over, you know, the there are all kinds of different ways of preaching the gospel. That's what I'm trying to say. That's what would be my response right away. That usually gets people going. Yeah.
Isn't there some stages of religious, he's a psychologist, what is it, James Fowler, and he has different levels of things, and that's one of them. And what he's saying is, most people never get up, most people in congregations never get out of level three or something, and you know, there's stages that are has developmental things. I think what you're getting at is, after the born again, you've got to develop more.
And it's true, as Graham and the others remind us, that the born-again experience has a long, honorable history on this. It was the born-again evangelicals who were the spearheads in the churches against slavery in America in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. Such people as Charles G. Finney, for instance, and Theodore Weld, you could go down the line, the Grimke sisters. remarkable pair of sisters who were very much involved in this, and they were the ones who took the unpopular position of, well, we'll put it this way, Finney would say that once you've been born again, unless you become an abolitionist, you haven't been born again. He put the two together. He said, you can't be a Christian and allow for the abomination of slavery to take place at the same time. And so Graham is calling people back to that sort of thing too.
I have a paradox about born again evangelicals that keeps running through my head, and I want to throw it out and have you comment. On the one hand, I see almost a sectarianism where they want to divorce themselves from the secular world, the private schools, the whole idea, you know, what you were talking about earlier. On the other hand, when I run into evangelicals, I find the most culture-dominated Christians, you know, American patriotism, God is an American God, the whole unquestioning of the universal aspect of and the worldwide communion. I mean, it's just, in a way, that's sectarian too, but in a way, and I'm wondering, as I think of this paradox, is there something about the American culture that's becoming sectarian and cut off from the world in which they're buying into that? Or what's going, you know, there's a paradox there. So.
Well, the evangelicals are not at all united about this, and I would recommend as one classic example, and in fact, the Holden Village, especially under John Tram, would be a very good example of what I'm getting at here. There is one group of people who practice what we call discipleship, known as the Sojourners. Yeah. Sojourners would be the classic example right away of what's going on, and we have their magazine here. And John, when he was here, had people from Sojourners speak here, and he had John Howard Yoder, and he had Ron Sider, and some of the other leading people come and talk and as examples of this. And Sojourners yield to nobody in their loyalty to evangelical doctrine and commitment, loyalties, values, all this sort of thing, and they spend their time now working out of Washington in discipleship, in peace and justice issues. And they are very critical of certain aspects of American life, the sexism, the racism, the ageism that takes place. They are not wholly wedded to a capitalist economy, to free market, supply and demand kind of economy, and work more in communal kind of terms. So this is an ongoing kind of conflict, which isn't going to go away. Most famous sort of definition of this was by H. Richard Niebuhr in 1951, I think, Christ in Culture came up, and where he defined five ways, Christ against culture, Christ in culture, Christ over culture, and he sees the left-wing people such as Sojourners as Christ against culture. And John Howard Yoder does this too, that the world is the enemy, and that therefore we have to stand in opposition to the world all the time. We have to make our witness to the world. The world is always trying to take over and infiltrate us and co-opt us. And this is why, and this gets into what we call the peace churches, Mennonite, Amish, Bruderhof, Hutterite, and these sort of things, where the one of the chief sources of energy really is opposition to the world. And that's why for instance, the Amish dress the way they do, and
I guess what I was saying, I'm very familiar with Sojourners, but I get their magazine, but I was thinking of more of these churches, these mega churches. You know, in one sense, we are just starstruck by the fact that the comment was made, these churches are growing like crazy, and that seems to be, say something very positive, cocaine is growing like crazy too, it's positive about that. But
I want to come back on that one, go ahead.
but the point is that I'm not talking about Sojourners, I'm talking about, my neighbors. And my neighbors, most of my neighbors don't take Sojourners, and my neighbors who are in the Born Again movement are people who I think are attracted to something quite different in the Born Again movement. And in one sense, it's that stand against culture, the private school. But in another sense, it's a very cultured kind of thing. It's red, white, and blue. I mean, I see that paradox running.
Yeah, very, very strong. And Graham himself, I talked about him last week, has amended some of his earlier, red, white, and blue flag-waving kind of patriotism, which he sees as something of a mistake at that time. But on the growth thing, that something came, I have to talk about that, because in 1972, as I mentioned to some of you, Dean Kelly from the National Council wrote this famous book, Why Conservative Churches Are Growing, and everybody got excited about this, because if Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witness, if they're growing, then maybe some, boards of social outreach and all the rest in the denomination said, maybe that's what we should do too, imitate or follow their growth patterns, the whole church growth movement at that time. And what they found after careful, demographic study here, was that when the people who were dropping out of the Episcopal Church and what is it, 15% or something, you know, catastrophic drop, I think, in the Episcopal Church, UCC and all the others. Those who were dropping out were not going into any other denomination. And where the growth came in the churches was not dropouts from Lutheran, or, you know, although the Lutheran dropout wasn't anywhere near as much as some of the others, but they were people who had been unchurched before, but were now being attracted because the faith was being made more intelligible to them in terms of this thing I call popular religion. And there's no question that there is a sharp differentiation that shows up in liturgy, that shows up in theology in many ways, between an educated clergy and the general populace. So some Baptist denominations don't require any seminary education at all for their pastors. One of the men I studied in the first book, Billy James Hargis, was ordained when he was 17 years old. And is considered a a minister in good standing. And a lot of people are turned off by the kind of high liturgical, highly scholarly kind of evidence that you'll find in the Episcopalian, the Lutheran, and Catholic churches, because we have at least 3 years of seminary education plus 1 year of internship that's required in the Lutheran Church. I think this is true in almost all the other denominations also. Some people don't want that and are attracted to the kind of celebrity-itis that I talked about before, and I think, and they don't find that they're being, how should I say this, that they're expected to sort of to grow in their understanding. Yeah, and I think there's a major difference that takes place there. Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to just add something to
what
Jim said, because the Old Testament is very much part of the Church of the Living Word, or faith temple, or whatever, you know. There, in fact, Christ is steeped in the Old Testament, so no way, and I think that should be known.
Yeah, okay.
All right, I've been Lutheran all my life, but I want to get that across, because that's important.
Thank you.
Whenever I hear interviews with, like, your celebrity born-again Christians and whatever, they are even ones that have always had a Christian faith, but they're celebrities, and so they're doing their witnessing, but they never seem to address themselves to a mainline denomination. You know, like, I belong to First Pres on or Second Baptist or whatever. Is it when they get on these shows they're told not to give any type of, because what I would, you know, if I didn't know better, like Dick Van Dyke was at least active with the Presbyterian Church on that, if I didn't know that some, you know, there are some big names attached to some mainline denomination, I would think that nobody famous ever joined one of the regular Protestant churches.
I don't know if they've been told that. I know that's not true with Schuller. Schuller doesn't give them that sort of thing. In fact, once I was surprised Schuller said something. He was interviewing Madeleine O'Hare, Murray O'Hare's son, and he had said that he hadn't met that person until just about 10 seconds before they went on the air, which may mean that there was a sudden switch, you know, in scheduling or something else like that, but Schuller doesn't do that. I have a suspicion that I just don't know about what happens ahead of time. I know I was never asked ahead of time by John Gallus or anybody the others that I was interviewed in the Twin Cities anything at all. They were just glad that the guest showed up. Because they got a free spot, and you know, I got a plug for the book, and so it was a mutual back scratching. But anyway, I think they would think that this is divisive when they get on these kinds of programs, because when you say Presbyterian or Lutheran, right away you're excluding all kinds of other people, and you're raising a kind of a flag or a warning signal there. They don't want, because they want to have the idea that we're all, you know. All
of
us together.
Millions of Presbyterians or Lutherans that would like to be reassured there is someone famous that's one of them.
Well, if you want to.
Besides hearing them on the Lutheran
If you want three celebrities today, Dan Rather is LCA, out of the Texas tradition, and he is also on the Board of Regents of Gustavus Adolphus College, if you didn't know that. One of my colleagues, Connie Gengenbach, is also on the Board of Regents, and she says he's a nice fellow. He comes out to Gustavus St. Peter. He's one celebrity. Another would be Senator Ernest Hollings from South Carolina. You didn't know that. My brother, who was very conservative, said he could at least support Ernest Hollings for the president. And when he found out that Hollings was Lutheran, well, that just settled it once and for all, and he started sending Hollings money and never got it back, but okay. And the third one, simply you didn't know, is Edwin Meese. Is a Lutheran.
Yes, unfortunately.
And I, as I say, I'm not going to editorialize.
Is it Eric Sephardt?
Eric? Eric himself, he dropped out. He grew up, that's an interesting connection with the other Holden connection. There's a Holden Lutheran Church about 20 miles from where we live. And that was named for the place in Norway where most of the people had come from. And Eric Severide's grandfather is buried there, which is proof, obviously, that he came from a very strict old Norwegian Lutheran tradition. But Severide himself never made any sort of formal church commitment, although he certainly understands the Lutheran tradition, right? But those would be three celebrities. But you see, the you get into that celebrity-itis sort of thing, and that's what I was trying to make a point. I think it's attractive to some people. Although last week we decided that probably there won't be any interviews for Miss America for a while on Billy Graham or some of the others, because that's getting to be rather embarrassing for at least a few people. Yeah.
You think that the possibility of increasing the technological emphasis in our society, that, like, I've had several friends who turned towards conservative churches, born again persuasion, I think, which they would see as a loss of personal relational intimacy with other people, with their family, with close relationship intimacy with people around them. And here's a gospel quote that is imaged in a personal, intimate, here's someplace I can be close. And
I think so much. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to talk about that. Okay. Okay. John used to say, if I'm in the driver's seat, that I should do the driving. Okay. Anyway. I think so much of that depends on the style of the specific congregation. Some people say, in using Twin Cities again, they don't want to join Mount Olivet because, what are there, 12,000 members? Up there with all the young gals and everything else. And other people have told me that that's the best thing that ever happened to them because they have the opportunity for specialized interests that you can't find in a small group. There's one called Community Edina, Edina Community Lutheran Church on about 48th. And they always pride themselves on not having any publicity. I went for an adult forum once, and I said, I had trouble finding you. And they said, that's right. They don't want to have a lot of publicity. So it depends on the style, very much so. Prince of Peace Lutheran in Burnsville, which I'm familiar with, has a great deal of appeal for just the reason you're talking about. Pastor Thompson, his Connie's son, has developed a certain style there that that a lot of people resonate to. And then others, I thought, people would respond to a stranger in church. It was a small Missouri church in the Twin Cities, and I went, boy, it is just like I had the plague or something. There was nothing. So I was in no mood to go back there again. Yeah. So I think that would be the answer. And sometimes, of course, it depends on the style of the minister, and I think we could go on forever on that one. You don't like the minister, therefore you lose the church, or you leave the church, and as though that should have anything to do with, anything. Yeah, you wanted
another
to get
thing.
In. This should be about the last one, yeah.
Yes. I sort of remember is in their approach to evangelism, a real attractive thing is, it's instant heaven as soon as you accept Christ.
There is a major theological question. The whole question there, you get into justification versus sanctification. How much do you change or grow in holiness, which is another way of defining sanctification, after the born-again experience? Graham actually says in his book, How to Be Born Again, that you take on a new nature. And you remember the Lutheran category, the Lutheran catechism, you're the same old sinner, the day you die is the day you were born. And we have to daily drown the old Adam. There's a basic conflict that goes on there between those two traditions, right? And which would strengthen, the sacramental character of the mainline churches. That's why the Eucharist is so important in the mainline churches, because sanctification is a goal, but not very much of a reality. And that's why, it's done through the church. Whereas the Lord's Supper in some of the Reformed traditions and the evangelical ones takes on the meaning of it being a memorial service. And doesn't have the clout that that it does in the mainline churches we're talking about there. That's a very, there's a head-on theological argument there that is never going to be resolved.
I'm just thinking in terms like they have the four spiritual laws or whatever it is.
Yeah.
We're sinners, and then
That's Bill Bright's Campus Crusade with the four spiritual laws. One last one.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with some of the stereotypes of born again Christians because, I think there are some that are like that, but there's also a lot of them who just don't stop once you become born again. And then, I can probably say I'm born again when I was eighth grade, and I probably told five different people that, and I've been to a Lutheran college, and I don't consider myself stopping and continuously going back to that born again experience, and I know a lot of my friends were very similar to that. So I think there's a danger in stereotyping born again.
Yeah, that's sure. That's why I said at the beginning I didn't want to, you know, sound judgmental. But I try to. What I'm trying to get at is why there are differences and why it seems so difficult for people to start to reconcile these kinds of differences. I'll tell Terry at Coffee that I've gone several times to conferences at Bethel Seminary in St. Paul, and afterwards I just don't understand what happened. Where I can go with some of my Episcopalian or Catholic friends, Presbyterian friends, and you know, we're grooving together. You know, what I'm trying to find out is why that's the case. And why can't we start talking? Because there's much more, you know, I like your idea, Terry, there's much more a clustering together of Roman Catholic and Lutheran and Episcopalians than had ever been the case before. And not so much, you know, with the others. And I'm not sure that that's going to be reconciled in the, you know, in the future. But also in the future is lunch. So let's see what's up there. Okay.